Hello everyone, and welcome to my review of Dr. Simon Bell's Romeo and Juliet at King's College Gardens. I saw it on the 5th of August and then again as the matinee on the 19th. The review is mostly going to be about the evening performance, partly because the setting is so spectacular then, and also because that's the way that most people will have seen it. But it does involve parts of the matinee as well, which I'll probably talk about at the end as a kind of contrast. As with Much Ado About Nothing in the first half of the festival, the audience were now facing the pergola, which was used to great effect. This means that the tiring house is to the right of pergola or to the left of the audience's viewpoint. So when you're walking into the venue to buy your tickets, you're actually very close to the tiring house and you can peek in and see some of the some of the scenic objects that they use during the play. There's also a small platform right in front of the pergola, which I don't really know the correct word for. It's like a small square, well, rectangular bed-like shape, which was used to great effect throughout the play for lots of reasons, but mainly for the bed for Romeo and Juliet's Night of Passion and where they were lying in the tomb at the end, bringing those two things as they're meant to be. Close together, sex and death, that's what we get all the time in the play. Romeo also used the pergola to hide when Mercutio was looking for him. Mercutio down below shouting out for Romeo hiding up at the top of the pergola and communicating with Benvolio and telling Benvolio not to tell Mercutio what was happening. It's very reminiscent of Benedict in the first half of the festival in Much Ado About Nothing. Probably the pergola's most startlingly apt moment was the balcony scene with its wonderful background as Juliet gives her famous speeches, and when she gets the line, a rose by any other name, she can actually look at a flower, which is kind of rose-like, right in front of her. It wasn't just used for vertical purposes. The long horizontal shape was brilliantly used for exits and entrances, and one example of that would be when the characters are making their masked entry into the early party. The boys are three amigos of Benvolio, Romeo and Mercutio were fooling around in front of the pergola, and then as their scene ended, they moved round and joined the end of the other actors who were moving towards the centre through the pergola passageway, as it were, so that they all arrived correctly at the same time for a wonderful dance. It was very neatly done. The reason I said I would concentrate on the 5th of August, or one of the reasons, was how spectacular it was to see it in the evening. You had the sunlight on the trees behind the pergola, very moving during various speeches, including Juliet's wonderful speech about bounty and bountiful. The sunlight was just hitting the very tall tree behind her and slowly going down, giving us the promise that the moon was going to rise, which it immediately started to do. So that by the end of the play, we had the moon right up high above the pergola, shining in the sky between two giant trees. It actually started to rise above just before Mercutio died, so it could hardly have been more carefully orchestrated. And as I say, at the end, the full moon was just very atmospheric, incredibly fitting. It was quite stunning, actually. We had the trusty old gauze with the light behind it, illuminating the dying or dead Romeo and Juliet. And the full moon above, between the two giant trees, as I say, it really was tremendously moving, the moon imagery and all the lines being particularly resonant. It was scenery to die for, in other words, and oh dear, no pun intended there. There was lots of other clever staging too. The CSF's famous for its simultaneous staging. Here we had Tybalt strutting his stuff while Romeo and Juliet were clasping hands and doing their sonnet when they first meet each other with the clasped hands, the pilgrim's kiss, etc. All of this to a background of music. Music was played throughout the play, recorded music, unlike most times at the CSF. But I'm not going to complain about it because it was extraordinarily effective from the opening to the most moving ending. The music was used very well indeed. Another example of the simultaneous staging would be when Romeo and Juliet are on stage in bed. Juliet is singing to Romeo as she strokes his head in her lap, but it's quite clear that this is their night together. Their one night together, of course. And as this is going on, Juliet's father is talking of marrying her off to Paris and that wedding. Even before the play opened, Gareth Llewellyn, who was later to play Friar Lawrence to such good effect, was walking up and down in the pergola with a scythe over his back. The Death Star lovers were clearly forecast before we'd even started. He returns with the scythe at the end to deliver the final lines as well. Foreboding was very much in the air. Some of the props that you could have spied in the Tiring House when you bought your tickets and were walking past perhaps would have included a toy animal, a shoe and an apple, all used to very good effect. And Juliet is trying to get Romeo's attention to say goodnight to him yet again, she has to throw an apple to him because he's wandered off in a daze of love, shall we say. So she throws an apple she's been eating to him, and of course he holds the apple and looks at where her teeth and her mouth have been in awe and simpering joy. And at times he almost speaks to the apple, he looks at the apple, and he holds the apple for a tremendously long time, actually. He holds it all the way to the interval, or at least he did on the 19th, where he then threw it into a member of the audience. She also has to throw a shoe at him at one point, which he also holds, and cuddles closely at one point. And she has, Juliet has, a toy stuffed animal that she speaks to before she realises that Romeo's overhearing her. This becomes a very important symbol of their love. It's passed from one to the other important points. Romeo carries it for some time, and then in the tragic end, in the tomb, the Capulet tomb, he brings it and lays it beside her. The toy animal represents their young love very well throughout, and that young love is played excellently by both Romeo and Juliet. They really are in giddy young love. Romeo by Michael Cummings is a sweet Romeo in the tradition, perhaps, if my memory serves me correctly, though it was a very long time ago, of the BBC, when the BBC covered every Shakespeare play. I seem to remember their Romeo being quite similarly attired and with quite a similar approach to the part. Apologies if my memory is playing up there. Jemima Watling was a radiant and absolutely captivating Juliet, managing to be the schoolgirl in love at the beginning, remembering that Juliet is only 13 in the play, or even younger according to the nurse, but mostly people saying she's 13. Quite startling to remember that her mother says there are women younger than her walking the streets of Verona who are already mothers, and that she herself was already a mother at the age of 13. But Jemima is the giggling schoolgirl at times, but she also has to grow and show the determination to face up to all that fate and society and the world is throwing at her, and that her parents are dictating that she do. She's some very, very rough passages to get through in the play, but she also has wonderful moments of humour with Romeo, and especially with the nurse. The nurse is marvellously played by Rachel Jill Davis. Just the right balance between mothering Juliet, being her close confidant, and especially when they fall out. I think that's the great thing about it. And again, the pergola is used very well here. When the nurse is, to Juliet's mind, very late in coming back with news of Romeo, we actually see the nurse coming through the pergola as Juliet's getting more and more angry, and Jemima was brilliant at this, as Juliet's getting more and more angry at the delay, and she starts mimicking the nurse, and she starts talking about how old people are slow, and the nurse is actually within earshot, so we know that the nurse is hearing this. This is a doubly good effect. It's funny in itself, but it leads into the long scene where the nurse delays getting any information on Romeo to the increasingly distracted Juliet, who's getting more and more worked up about it. This seems all the more fitting because of what the nurse has overheard. Juliet, in fact, is getting her just desserts. It's usually a great scene anyway, and it's usually played that the nurse is just doing it out of good-natured fun. But here there's a point behind it as well, so she well deserves her massage on her back, her temples being nursed, and so forth, and she well deserves drawing out the news. It doesn't bring any badness to their relationship. Her joy at Juliet's joy at the news that Romeo's waiting to marry her is just as fulsome as ever. The whole scene was just marvellously done. It was tremendous interplay between the two of them. Romeo had his friends to interplay with, the three amigos, as I called them. The partnership between Mercutio, Benvolio and Romeo is always crucial. There has to be a bond between them, and there certainly was. Timothy Weston playing Benvolio, that's quite an interesting pair of roles Timothy had this year, actually, having already played Horatio in Hamlet. He's very much the trusted friend this year. But he did get beaten up quite a lot. When Tybalt comes into it, a few more later, he really lays into Timothy, and Timothy takes a good beating, and then the nurse wallops him later. I'm beginning to think that this is a year where all my friends get beaten up on stage. It's getting harder and harder just to sit there and not complain or rush to the defence, though my rather diminutive stature might not bring much help to them, especially with my aged years. Teddy Corbett is a completely over-the-top Mercutio, exaggerated to the nth degree, so much so that I can hardly remember him from the Antony and Cleopatra in the first half of the festival, where he played Agrippa as one of his roles. Here he was, an extravagantly over-the-top Mercutio. I wasn't quite sure how to take it the first time, actually, but I thoroughly enjoyed it by the end, and I thoroughly enjoyed it all the way through the second time. I think I just have an image in my mind of Mercutio, and he was so different from that that it took me a little bit of time to adjust. As you may be aware, if you visit my website, there are lots of reviews there from visiting pupils from overseas schools, and almost to a man and a woman, or a boy and a girl, they enthuse wildly over Teddy's contribution. He must be exhausted after it. He puts so much energy into it, not only when he's in part, but when there are dances, he's usually one of the most active members there. But the passion with which he says many of his famous lines is quite extraordinary. During the Queen Mab speech, he really loses it, I mean deliberately loses it, twice in fact. He's losing it completely, and Benvolio goes and puts a comforting hand on his shoulder. It's a very touching look in Timothy Weston's face when he does this, a very calming hand on his shoulder, and calms him down for a bit. But then Mercutio, a few minutes later, is up and over the top again with his face bright red and seemingly almost about to burst with emotion. You can see the bond between our oh-so-sociable boys when Romeo rejoins them after his escapade, and they're not really realising he's moved from Rosalind to Juliet yet. But they're just Mercutio's just delighted to have him back, and declares, "Now art thou Romeo." And they have a wonderful little dance routine, very sort of teenage stuff, which went down very well with the audience. I've just realised that I forgot to say various things about the nurse and Juliet. So if you're an actor listening to this and only listening for your own parts, I'm afraid that you're going to have to listen to the whole thing, because you're going to come in and out of it all over the place. I just remembered that the excruciating scene where Juliet's mother's trying to speak to her, I mean excruciating in a comic way, obviously, Juliet's mother's trying to talk to her and the nurse just won't shut up. It just goes on and on and on forever. That was brilliantly done. Juliet and the nurse were sitting on the little platform thing, and the nurse was telling her story repeatedly with the punchline at which she always laughs hysterically. And by the third time she told the story, she laughed so hard that she actually fell off the platform, which was a lovely moment. As usual with the comic moments, it won't come across on the review, but for all of you there, hopefully it brings back the memory of it. It was very, very funny both times I saw it. As was the nurse taking Romeo's money, when Romeo gives her a message to take to Juliet, he's going to give her a coin, and she says, "Oh no, she couldn't possibly," and before grabbing his entire coin purse and putting it in her basket. It's very good. I also forgot to say that one of Juliet's great lines came a bit, I was actually talking about when Juliet is mocking the nurse for being late and talking about old people and mimic her and so forth, and I said that the nurse was overhearing this from the in the background, and that was very effective. Juliet actually changes her voice when she sees the nurse there. "Oh my God, here she comes. Oh my God, here she comes," she says, in a just a delightful way, which again got an outburst of immediate laughter. I also didn't mention both Juliet and the pergola in another of their finest moments. This was when Juliet ran screaming in delight. She'd just been told by the nurse that Romeo was waiting to marry her. So she runs off screaming in delight. She comes out and she goes right round the whole of the centre of the college gardens, screaming all the way. And which goes on and on and on. And the audience were rocking with laughter because as the play is going on in front of you with the Romeo and the Friar, all you hear is her screaming and screaming. And you can sort of plot her route as you hear her. And then finally she appears around the other side of the stage. This, you know what I mean by stage, the grass front, and she arrives on what we'll call the stage where the Friar and Romeo wait, and she leaps into Romeo's arms after all this long run and shrieking with glee, and she launches herself into Romeo's arms to loud applause from the audience. I mentioned Tybalt briefly before. Well, James Eakin's Tybalt is a strong, brooding, menacing, dark and violent. In other words, just right. He explodes into the play in violence and dies after his violent exchanges with Mercutio and Romeo, as we all know. As he's fighting Mercutio, Romeo is actually mocking the fight behind them, applauding and just passing it off as two young boys having a silly game. And this made the stabbing of Mercutio all the more shocking. We went from comedy to tragedy in a heartbeat, and the great heart of Mercutio was stopped, though not before, of course, the most wonderful of life leaving, leave-taking lines. Mercutio comes back in looking totally demented and focused at the same time. Yes, I know that's contradictory, but that was the look on his face before he then had to fight Romeo. Now, James Eakin also played Paris, one of the most contrasting of the doubles you could imagine, because Paris was a kind of foppishly dressed Paris. And to be honest, he was downright unpleasant. His sulky greeting of the dead Juliet when he threw his flowers down and stomped off seemed to me, not the Paris that I usually imagine. Of course, Paris isn't liked by the audiences of Romeo and Juliet. We all love Romeo and we all want him to get Juliet, and we don't want Paris to be involved at all. But it's a kind of odd thing, really. It's a very clever thing that Shakespeare does. He makes you feel this, but in the text of the play, Paris does nothing wrong. In fact, Paris does everything right, unlike Romeo. And I think quite clearly with the names Paris and Romeo, so Paris and Rome, in other words, Shakespeare's saying, much like Demetrius and Lysander in A Midsummer Night's Dream, there's nothing really to pick between them. Juliet falls madly in love with Romeo, or Rome, but she might as well have wanted to travel to Paris instead, and fallen madly in love with Paris. They're both supposed to have similar virtues, so that Paris and Rome are two cities that any English person would like to go and visit, and Paris and Romeo are two young men that any women would be pleased to marry. I think that's supposed to be the idea, and that's why the nurse does hesitate, but the nurse thinks the sensible course when everything's gone badly wrong is to go with Paris after all. She does extol Paris's beauty before she realizes that Juliet's in love with Romeo, and before she extols Romeo's beauty. So they're clearly both supposed to be handsome men and good catches. However, as I say, audiences always feel totally against Paris and totally for Romeo, one of the great triumphs of the play, really. And this play actually plays straight into that and makes Paris completely non-empathic at all, really. You have no feelings for Paris at all, except possibly some hatred and scorn when he throws down the flowers and stomps off in a sulky huff with the dead Juliet lying in front of him. This partly plays into, and indeed is part of, the cuts in the play, especially in the second half. So you don't actually get very much of Paris, and you don't get him visiting the tomb at all, for example. But before talking about cuts and the length of the play, I haven't yet mentioned Lord and Lady Capulet, and I've kind of kept them to the end because I don't like them. Not because I don't like them as actors, of course. Anthony Sargent and Liz McMillan are very, very good at the parts, but that doesn't help because they're such horrible parts. The bit where they attack Juliet is really unbearable. I've mentioned this in previous reviews of the play. I can never really take to it. Anthony Sargent does it with full brutality, not only hitting Juliet, but pulling at her hair at one point and throwing his wife to the ground. Liz McMullen as the mother was positively vitriolic as she spat in Juliet's eyes and declared that, "I have done with thee." Not long after that, they think, erroneously of course, they think that Juliet has decided that she will marry Paris after all, and the father's pleased, and the mother tries to get back into Juliet's good books. Juliet, of course, coldly sends her off, but you can't even stand the fact that they're trying to get back with her. They do, however, and they have to, seem genuinely shocked and saddened by Juliet's death. Somehow they acted this so well that you didn't feel resentment that not long before they had been so cruelly berating and abusing her. It was not long before, partly because of the cuts that I mentioned before, the second half of the play and the ending, although the ending between Romeo and Juliet wasn't truncated, but the second half of the play and the ending overall seemed a bit rushed and pushed for time. This is my only criticism, really, and it's not that much of a criticism, given the fact that, for goodness sake, all of what was achieved with a cast of nine, which really just beggars belief. Just a tremendous achievement from the director and all the actors to put this on with a cast so small. However, it did seem, I have to say, a little bit rushed, because there's a double problem at King's, and the problem is the toilets. If you have a 15-minute break, there's nowhere near enough for the toilet queue. The toilet queue, in fact, is more or less just about formed when the play restarts, and then you have the whole of the second half interrupted by people returning to their seats. So what they did on August the 5th was they announced an interval of 25 minutes. Now, in the length of play that you get that at the CSF, that really is just far too long, apart from breaking the mood of the play. However good the actors are, it is going to break the mood that long. It doesn't actually work for reducing the toilet. What happens is, let's say the interval starts at 9 o'clock, people who wouldn't go to the toilet if it was a 15-minute break, by the time it gets 20 minutes into a 25-minute break, decide that they're going to go to the toilet, and so there's still a huge queue at 9:25. I know this because I was trying to sell the book during the interval, and I went to the loo at the end of the interval, and the queue was enormous. So unfortunately, it doesn't really work anyway. I'm not blaming anybody for this. It's an insoluble problem, given the scarcity of facilities at the venue. The more I talk about the play, the more I remember things I've forgotten. There was a lovely touch for the blood when Benvolio comes back to report the death of Mercutio. There was a lovely touch to represent Mercutio's blood when Benvolio smeared blood from his hand, Mercutio's blood this is, smeared blood from his hand onto Romeo's face. He'd actually picked the blood up on the mulled wine table, which I thought was a very good use of the limited props, etc., that you can have in an open-air stage. And another very nice touch was that at the end of the play, Lord Capulet smeared Juliet's blood onto Lady Capulet's face in exactly the same way as Benvolio had to Romeo, linking those two very well at the in imagery, as it were. I also didn't praise the dancing nearly enough. There was dancing straight after the prologue, which was very effective. Again with music, and again with music, the masked ball. There was tremendous dancing there, very energetic, very well choreographed and coordinated. We got nine actors, and we had four pairs, and we had Mercutio alone. Again, the sense of foreboding, Mercutio's end was going to come before any of the other eight. He was a loner, and he was about to be expended. As Shakespeare turned the play from comedy to tragedy. The opening and ending were very carefully staged, so much so that the ending was almost too moving. Juliet was very active after taking the sleeping draught that was supposed to put her in a death-like coma, because it took time to take effect. They used this to tremendous effect, with whole parts of her speech coming after she'd lain down and then sprung back up again, wondering why she wasn't asleep, wondering if, in fact, the friar worried that he was going to be forced into a position of marrying her to Paris, having already married her to Romeo, couldn't do that, and therefore had given her real poison. And she dismisses that, and she lies back down again. Then she wakes up with another thought that the poison isn't going to work, and so forth. And then eventually the poison takes effect, she screams violently twice, which I wasn't expecting, as though she really is dying and as though she's in great pain. And normally she just goes to sleep or goes into a coma. That shriek actually reminds me of another very violent act in the play that I didn't really quite get a grasp on so much. When when the friar is explaining to Juliet that she's going to take this sleeping draught and she's going to appear as dead, and then later on she's going to wake up and everything's going to be okay. Oh, I wish. When he's explaining all that, and he's explaining what the medicine he's giving her will do to her, he grabs her by the throat and strangles her very, very violently, as though he's strangling her to death. A few minutes after that, she actually has a revenge attack on him, where she grabs him by the throat and momentarily strangles him. I wasn't very sure what this was really aiming to do, and I have to say that the people who talked to me after the play about it, their view of it was at the very best puzzlement, but more commonly very antipathetic towards it. They didn't get it at all. I took a guess in sort of trying to explain to them what I thought might be happening, was that it was because of the cuts, there weren't so many speeches about death and the prefiguring of the ending that is so prevalent in the text maybe had to be shown by this violent image, that the medicine actually would lead to her death in the end, and that it was violent, and just really to prefigure the tragic ending, I suppose, is what I took it to mean. Anyway, just a point there. Hopefully somebody can come back to me and say to me if I've got that right, or if I've misread it, and if I missed something. But if I did miss something, I'm afraid everybody I spoke to who'd been to the play also missed it. Hardly a big thing, however, in over 2 hours of virtually non-stop triumphant staging and marvellous playing by everyone. At the end, it's Benvolio and the Capulet parents who carry off the final words. They have to be economic, of course, with only 9 actors. That's actually a third of the actors on the stage at that moment. As I said, the death scene itself was extraordinarily moving, especially at night with the moon behind. But I should point out that in complete contrast, the bright daylight of the afternoon performance did allow one to see very clearly what was going on inside the gauze tent, and as I mentioned before, it was almost too moving. I was very privileged to be sitting at the front, and so I had a close-up view of exactly all of this happening. And I admit a fleck of dust must have come into my eye when I saw the little stuffed toy, being carefully laid beside Juliet's body. I was surrounded, as one is if we go to the front of the matinees, by the casts from the other plays. And although everyone's very friendly and I'm always very pleased to be near them, I do find it, they probably laugh to hear this, but I do find it somewhat intimidating, as I am a little bit in awe. Not only that, but I see most of you as the characters you are. So, you know, I sort of see Hamlet and I see Hermia, as well as the people that you are. But I had to be there so that I could jump up and explain the idea behind selling my book for charity on the day, which went very well. No little thanks to the actors who came. After one gentleman had come, it looked like nobody else was going to come and buy a book, but the actors who came and chipped in made other audience members come in behind you, so well done and thanks for that. Memories of the play keep coming back to me. I remember Gareth as the friar saying to Romeo, who was rushing about excitedly, "They stumble that run fast," and then Mercutio at that very moment ran fast onto the stage, and of course again we knew he was about to stumble, yet another prefiguring foreboding of a death to come. I also didn't make nearly enough of how good Juliet was in the balcony scene, and Romeo too. The famous speeches there were so very well done, as so much was throughout the day and the evening. I think I better close here, because I'll just keep remembering bits and be frustrated that no matter how much I remember, there'll be other things that I haven't said. So, a triumph. Congratulations, my last review of the year, somewhat bittersweet, but we've still got a week to go with 2 plays still running.